Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great show lined up for you this evening with our regular weather updates and a special guest coming on the show with us. We can't get kicked into that stuff, though, until I bring in my guest host, or actually co-host, not a guest host at all, Sam Bradley. Sorry about that, Sam.
Oh, that's all right. We've done this how many years, Jamie? That's okay. Done a lot of years. But yeah, we do have a return guest tonight. Someone I'm really very much looking forward to talking to because it's a subject that we've discussed a number of times that it's critically important to all of us. So we'll look forward to that. But and we have Dr. Joe on with us. Hi, Joe.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
And then we got Kyle that is going to give us an update on the weather. So, Kyle.
Hey, thanks, Sam, and good day to everyone out there in the disaster podcast realm. Meteorologist Kyle Nelson here. Quick weather update, weather roundup, if you will. Since our big outbreak of tornadoes and severe weather back on March 1st, it's been fairly quiet across the U.S. Weather-wise, save a recent outbreak on March 6th from especially the upper Mississippi River Valley, including 41 reports of tornadoes. So big-time severe weather, but mostly high wind reports there, and that extended from Minnesota and Wisconsin in the north all the way down to Oklahoma and Arkansas. So also we had some high winds and snow in the central and southern Rockies this past weekend, with some ridgetop or mountaintop locations recording wind gusts in excess of 100 miles per hour. Wow. At Buttermilk, the area where I work, or Ski Patrol, actually, we clocked an 85 mile per hour wind gust overnight on this past Sunday night. So it was real and it was ripping even down into the valleys. Looking ahead, though, currently tonight, the southeast U.S. is under the gun for severe weather, with a line of storms already underway from Louisiana extending up through Missouri into Alabama. Excuse me, Mississippi into Alabama. And also in the recent or upcoming weather things, fire weather is a big topic coming up for the eastern Central Plains, from eastern Colorado to the mid-Missouri Valley. And as we talked about a few episodes ago, high winds, low humidity, and dry fuels can lead to a very explosive fire growth. But looking ahead, heavy precip in the Pacific Northwest, below normal temps in Montana and Minnesota, and also in the New England states, and some heavy precipitation coming in the southern Mississippi River Valley into the Virginias.
You know, Carl, I was going to mention that because it's odd for me, coming from California, that whenever we had those red flag fire warnings, it was always because it was so hot. So here it is, we're getting red flag fire warnings, but I'm freezing my butt off. So it just seems kind of weird. I'm realizing it isn't a factor at all of the temperature. It's a factor of the humidity and the winds, correct?
Those are the two biggest factors, especially with a lot of the westerly flow that we've had. Those winds, when they downslope from the Continental Divide down east into the Denver area and out onto the plains, those all that moisture has been squeezed out in the mountains, and so it's pretty dry air down there. I was down there in Denver teaching last week, and I was like, wow, my skin is actually super dry. You know, living up in the mountains, it's usually not too bad, but it was excessively dry down in Denver, so it was very apparent to me that humidity was quite low.
Kyle, just a quick question, because you were talking about the high winds in the mountains and the snows that have come. Does that have any effect on avalanche risk when you have high winds like that, or is it just part of the picture?
Oh, high winds can lead to much increased avalanche risk for several reasons, not the least of which is the wind transport of the snow that's already fallen and that's also falling currently. So the windward sides will kind of get scraped bare by the wind, and all that snow will be transported and deposited on the leeward or downwind sides of those ridges and peaks and things. So you can have certain aspects or certain directions that the slopes face load up with a very high amount of snow in a very short period of time, and that can lead to locally increased avalanche danger on those leeward slopes.
Thank you. Just kind of something that occurred to me, and I thought we'd touch on it while we had you here.
For sure.
No, that's a good question, Jamie. Very good question, because it's ever-present. You know, I'm wondering about that in California, where they've had drought for so long, and now they're getting such a massive amount of snow in the mountains. They're probably not used to it. So I'm sure they're out there in force dealing with avalanches, which, of course, Joe Hawley, you don't have those in Memphis, correct?
I do not have any avalanches in Memphis currently.
What do you have down there? How has it been in Memphis?
Well, we had a line of pretty aggressive storms and wind today that have kind of already blown through, and it's cooling off a little bit tonight. But going to be nice the rest of the week.
Very good. I'm sure it's better than that heat and humidity that you get in the summer, so it's all good. Well, let's jump in.
We've had a mild winter.
That's excellent. Nothing wrong with that. So I want to introduce our guest tonight. We've talked to him before, although it's been a while. Dan McGuire has a company that deals with CISM, and he's the guy that they call on the really big incidents. And as much as we've talked about the field level of dealing with CISM issues, critical incident management, he actually approaches it from the perspective of discussing it with management, which is a key factor in this that I don't think anybody else does. So Dan's got a new program out that he sent us an email out. So we want to talk to him about that. And some of the, I can remember some of the key points that he brought up the last time we talked to him. So how are you, Dan?
I am great. And again, thanks for having me on. And thank you for the weather report. Being a weather maniac myself, it's kind of nice to hear the weather reports across the country. About 18 months ago, after one of my clients had their second suicide in their department, had me come in and do a lecture. It was nothing like a debriefing or anything like that, but just more of an explanation of why does somebody choose to take their life and what can lead up to that, and what are all the barriers that are in front of both the person who is considering suicide but also the folks who are saying, I never saw this, I never thought he, she would do that, and many of those endless questions. And I finally made a decision about 18 months ago to really drill down, if you will, to all levels within the emergency agencies, and especially at the leadership, the ones who are seeing their folks out in the streets every day and supervising them and making sure, I guess I took their temperature, if you will, of just what was their awareness of what are you going to do, not if, but when a suicide hits your agency. And the blank stare scared me, truly scared me. And that's why I realized quickly that you know, we have some great organizations out there now that are doing much good work out there, but I'm trying to get it down to the micro level, the maybe 10-foot level, if you will, to empower the leadership that this is going to happen, and when it does, it is going to stop you cold in your feet, and there is going to be a pall, P-A-L-L, that is, a pall hanging over your agency for quite some time, because there is so much responsibility guilt that bubbles up. There is so much of the coulda, shoulda, woulda that anyone in EMS or any of the emergency services beats themselves quite often with. So I try to look at it at a different, instead of just throwing out just another suicide awareness program, is looking at two different levels, primarily going to that leadership, the people who are going to be overseeing these responders day in and day out, the ones who are going to be hearing the folks that are calling in sick 2 days, 3 days, 4 days in a row, and they can't quite figure out what's going on, if there is anything. And then also a very, very frank and open discussion for those who are in the field every single day. And unfortunately, this department that I'm talking about just had their third suicide now in 5 years. So that has just really turned up my volume. And we just have to get out from around the barriers, the stigmas, the paradigms, the fears of just simply openly talking about this. Those of us that are on the call tonight, we could talk about intubations and cardioversion till the wee hours of the morning. However, in most of these emergency agencies, you bring up the word suicide, and it deadens the conversations. And as well as the thought process. And something that I've had to do, one of the other things that my company is well known for is we help agencies create line-of-duty death pre-plans and programs. And it was just 2 years ago that we added an entire module. All right, how are you going to handle if somebody commits suicide, and what are you going to be your reactions versus somebody who commits suicide and takes out other people and causes damage? And how are you going to even organize any type of memorial or funeral for that person? So that there's a real slice down the middle when you start pulling this thing apart a little bit more, that's starting to open up the eyes of the organizations. And that's why this program that we've introduced is to help the departments to get out of their comfort zones. And that's, in fact, the opening statement that I did with some of the test programs that we ran last fall is I am not here to talk gently about the topic of suicide and PTSD, but I am going to be here to shove you out of your comfort zones to the point where you are going to have to start thinking about this and start preparing for it. Very much like going back 15 years ago when I started the line of duty death consulting work, nobody wanted to talk about that. Nobody wanted to touch that. That atmosphere is a little bit more clear, but with the numbers that I read from 2016, the number of documented, and that's a key word, documented suicides within emergency services was in excess of 40% higher than what we were education guess back in the beginning of 2016. So we're seeing the trend that, okay, departments are starting to report this more often, but they're still helpless because they don't know how do we approach the family and how do we take care of our own, because a suicide just rattles a organization right to its foundation. And there's so many agencies out there that are experiencing these, and they don't know what to do first, second, third, and many numbers beyond that.
So, Dan, do you think a lot of this is such a shock because some of these management teams are in the "it can't happen to us" mindset? It happens to other organizations, but not to ours. And then when it does...
That is very much what I ran into when I worked so hard and really had to kick open some doors about the line of duty death preparation is, well, we have EAP. That's not enough. and that will not be enough to prevent somebody's suicide. There's one thing that is a very important point that I want to make sure I, before I forget it tonight, and that I really use in my discussions with these agencies. Suicide for someone who is that mentally positioned in hopelessness and helplessness, and as we all know, as emergency responders, we're all very addicted to control, because that's what's expected of us. When someone dials 911, they expect us to show up and take their crisis and bring it to control and happily go on our way. Well, in that same theory is, after research and talking to folks who attempted suicide, many times we have heard that this was their last grasp of total control over their life, because they had lost their total control over their life because of maybe substance abuse. It may be that they are performing poorly within their organizations. They may be going through a divorce. Maybe their one of their children is starting to use alcohol or drugs, or there's a myriad of applications towards that. And I know, as a retired EMS responder and a past chief, that we have to have control when we do our job. We have to have control of our 360. We have to have control of anything that's changing, whether it's a simple cardiac arrest or if it's a five-alarm warehouse fire. We have to be aware of things that are changing literally by the minute. And when we start losing that sense of control, that is one of the very key concepts that we teach in the CISM programs, is because we are, again, control addicts, and when we start to feel that we no longer have control over our emotions, our fears, our reactions, our outlook going forward, that just stops us again in our tracks. And when you've got somebody who is mentally ill, add in the substance abuse potential, which is very high, there within is the perfect mix of I can't take the physical or the psychological pain anymore. And unfortunately, in our line of business, we are shamed and we are ridiculed and we are thought as the, as I call it, the boohoo billies. If we ask even our first line supervisor, you know, hey, I'm having some difficulties, I think I need some professional help. And without that support, without that empathetic support immediately up front, which is rare, as you just said, Sam, these people are completely lost. They have nowhere to go, and they get into a tailspin mentally and spiritually and physically. And all the thing that they realize, okay, everything is out of control, but this is my last approach, my last attempt at total control over what is going to happen to me, and I am going to commit suicide. And quite often when those who wake up from the suicide attempt that they were not successful, they are very angry people. They are very upset people because, again, this is one more basket I've got to manage of the embarrassment of attempting suicide. What are my peers going to think of me? What are my family going to think of me? So that's why I really want to drill down and get to the people who are seeing their people day in and day out, and really just bust down, break down, whatever word you want to use, the stigmas and the paradigms that way too many leaders have, that this is not going to happen in my agency.
Well, Dan, let's broaden the perspective a little bit, because we have Joe, who's an ER doc, as well as a USAR doc.
Right.
We've got Kyle, who works ski patrol, and I remember at least one ski patroller when I was doing that who committed suicide. Jamie works in a number of different venues. I was at Ground Zero. Joe was at the Pentagon. So you've got all of the disaster. These are the same responders that you're talking about. Now we're throwing them into a disaster scenario. And something like, you know, Ground Zero, you don't walk away from and forget about. So, you know, I think it's all kind of the same. People are bringing in the same amount of baggage. Like you mentioned, there's a lot of personal issues going on that start integrating with work issues that are going on until the person is just oversaturated and can't deal with it anymore. Joe, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. Matter of fact, you had exactly my thought. I was really curious to know if there was any kind of correlation between sort of disaster response and, you know, is it higher in that group? Is it even known? Does that seem to predict anything for folks that make those kind of responses, et cetera? I'm really just curious to know if there's any differential from that group from more traditional EMS responders.
There definitely is a large addition to that, and there are reports that have come out of both the Pentagon and also Ground Zero that, you know, there were a large jump of suicides, and now that we're running into this, what they call Ground Zero cancer, that is something that I'm concerned personally about, that this is going to be yet another jump that I don't want to go down another path of being sick and being a burden on my family because of the staunch pride within the responders who especially work Ground Zero. Again, they don't want to put their family through all the medical bills, the medical tests, and the bad news, and as things progress more and more to the negative side. Again, it's a easy way to, it's a perverse way in a sense that I'm protecting my family from not having to go through all this cancer treatments and all the ugliness that comes with that by just simply taking my life, and they're not going to be burdened with that. And then immediately they're burdened with this sudden loss of their loved one through suicide, which has so many both religion and custom issues that go along with that as well. And there is definitely a correlation out there. And but what we're seeing is those who are committing suicide now. And again, the numbers are hard to get. I have to be upfront with everybody. Not everybody reports suicides, and especially on law enforcement. There's a lot of guys who die by cleaning their gun, which is a underground statement of somebody who took his own life. There's this such these high expectations that I think we're seeing in the emergency services that some of us are just no longer able to manage or reach out to those levels any longer. And I'm watching from the sidelines just wondering, we've got to get the information out here, out before it happens. And that's why I'm releasing this program nationwide to shake the management to realize that this is closer than you think, and don't fool yourself any longer. We did that with many other issues in fire EMS systems that we just didn't think would ever happen in our backyard or in the back of our ambulance, and guess what? It does, it will, and it will continue to happen.
Jamie, any thoughts?
Well, I'm just curious, Dan, you know, what are your solutions? I mean, what are the potential things that management can do? One of the things I heard you talk about was reporting, and I think that when we have good data, we can better understand the scope of the problem in our own departments.
Exactly.
So yep. Maybe does it start with reporting better on suicides in a department and then looking at response after the fact?
Well, I think it even takes a step further back than that is with the leadership, getting them to even to say the word suicide and be willing to sit in a room for an hour and to openly talk about this, because quite often the most common question that I get is, what do we need to look for? Because they simply, so many people are, and then this goes back to my being a board certified grief counselor, you know, we've had discussions on this podcast before about just the resistance of just talking about end of life issues. And because when we start, you put in a room 30 or 40 of the supervisors and management level folks, and you start talking about, you know, you've got a high potential of your own people committing suicide or suicide ideation, the immediate thing is they want to recoil from that word because suicide has such a negative connotation. And then right behind that is that's driving them to think of their own mortality. And that's one of the strongest forces in the human psyche I have ever had to deal with.
I think, you know, what Jamie's touching on is communication. And I think this works from the ground up. And I know one thing I taught for many years is your partner knows you probably better than most people, especially if there's been a long-standing relationship. That partner should try it, even if they're not trained as a CISM counselor. They will pick up on those signs, especially if they're aware of the call this person may have been on that may have started this freight train rolling. But by the same token, they need to go to management if they know this person's not responding, if they know this person's crying out for help but won't do it, to management for whatever reason, and then management needs to know where to go with it and to take it seriously.
Exactly, and as I put in the press release, when you're approaching somebody that you're concerned about, the approach has got to be spot on, perfect, and you don't need to be a CISM trained responder. In fact, there is a portion of the CISM entire program called the SAFER model, S-A-F-E-R,
yes,
which is the perfect two-hour training to train anybody to how to approach anyone that they're concerned about. And, Sam, you've got it right on the head is, the partner that I'm working with day in and day out for years after years, I get to know them often better than my own biological family, and that's what I call the dual versus dueling families. I'm spending more time with my responder family member than I am quite often with my spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend, and they know when something's wrong often quicker than my biological family does. And again, helping them to remove the awkwardness of even asking the question, is everything truly okay? You know, everybody goes out there and asked the word, are you fine? And, of course, I'm fine. That's the immediate response anybody's going to get who is suffering. But learning to look for body language, voice, tone, inflection, volume, can they even keep eye contact with you? Have they not shaven or bathed in 2 or 3 days? You know, there are just so many small underground signals that can be taught for us to start being more aware of our partners out there every day.
Exactly. Kyle, you have any thoughts or questions on this? I don't know how familiar you are with this topic, but thought I'd give you a chance to jump in.
Well, Sam, it's actually a topic that I've become quite familiar with on the ski patrol side. We've had a few incidents in the past couple of years that have really brought the critical incident stress management piece front and center. And so I think the biggest thing is, you know, kind of to echo some of the comments that have already been made, is to really not just empower the leadership, but empower the, you know, kind of the boots on the ground folks to be, you know, the eyes and ears of the leadership to monitor, especially after these types of incidents occur. And that was one of the biggest things that I noticed, was that people, whether ski patrol or other agencies I've worked with before, if they're not comfortable with going to leadership, perhaps, you know, someone will say something about, like, hey, you know, how are you feeling? And of course, the response, as they say, is, oh, I'm feeling okay. I'm doing just fine. I'm handling it well. And once you can get that person in a comfortable setting and get them talking, perhaps maybe sharing a past experience that you've had that was difficult, that can get them to really open up. And I think I found personally that just talking through an incident is really helpful and really helps to kind of bring some closure at the end of it. And I think that's another piece as well that has helped. Not just me, but several of my colleagues, is, you know, yes, you run the call, you know, whether if it goes good or bad, you know, just kind of getting that final outcome, bringing that personal closure to that responder, those responders who were on that scene, to allow them to kind of close that out in their mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you said a very important word, is talk, and something that I teach intensely in both the basic and the advanced CISM, is talk is cathartic, and that's such an ancient therapy that we've been using without realizing it for thousands of years, and just getting ourselves to talk about it reduces and lowers the fear levels of that incident. The more we talk about it, the more opportunity we have to tell our story. And that continues that cathartic process, so it stays in a healthy, moving forward motion. And it goes back to what we've been saying in CISM for forever. Let's get to it before it gets to them, and that goes to right back to talking to these supervisors, these owners of these organizations. Even sometimes we have to get that high in these organizations for them to really understand. And there's dollar figures I can put on the table in front of them. What is it going to cost you if this person just walks out because they can't take it anymore? What's it going to cost you to replace a fully trained, fully up to speed paramedic, EMT, firefighter? What's it going to cost you to replace that person, put them through academy, buy all their gear, get them on the trucks and the ambulances for 2 or 3 years so they can pick up where that other person just left off? We're into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So sometimes, unfortunately, we have to look at it at a fiduciary level of, this is going to cost you this many dollars if you're not going to take this subject on more seriously. And that, unfortunately, is where, excuse me, I get the most attention, is when we start talking about replacement dollars when somebody either walks off the job or somebody who does commit suicide. It's a sad fact, but that's what catches the upper management's attention often much quicker.
Not to mention the effect on all the other guys in the department. They're brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And they're all going to be affected by this, especially if they didn't see it coming. Kyle, you have a question?
Yeah, just I'm kind of curious because I'm actually part of several virtual teams, both for social media monitoring, weather decision support, and other things. And specifically with our social media monitoring teams during hazardous events, whether, you know, natural or man-made, there can be some pretty disturbing images that come out of those, truly raw with that information. And I'm wondering if you've seen or if you have talked to any virtual folks that operate in more virtual space as opposed to just the kind of boots on the ground, hands-on first responders, and if you're seeing any types of trends for critical incident stress and things like that in our with our virtual teams.
I have not seen any of that yet, but you mentioned a very important terminology that we're trying to use more often. When people see these disastrous images, and it could be somebody on Facebook or on the local news seeing that entire town is wiped out where it doesn't even look like a town, we have a term for that called the imprints of horror. It's the sights, sounds, smells, and even the taste that our brain is taking in, even though we're in that autopilot mode of doing our job where we're no longer thinking, we're simply doing the job because of our training and of our just what our gut is telling us what to do. We're still bringing in all of these imprints, and that is often what's left over in many of these people's minds of, I can't get this out of my head any longer, because they really didn't even realize my brain was taking this data in. But to answer your question, with virtual reality, I have not seen anything formally on that as a treatment base, perhaps, or even an educational base.
Well, you know, it sounds like the bottom line is it's what you do and what Joe does with Paragon is it's training, and it's training at all levels. It's training the field, it's training the partners, it's training what you know, the important piece that you do, training management, not only what to, knowing that it will happen and what to expect, but what to do about it. I think that's basically what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think we all have this equal same passion for that, is until we can get the correct decision makers, and that decision maker could be a first level supervisor who determines, okay, this crew is fine in his mind because of his own personal feelings of what is a critical incident and what defines a critical incident within himself versus what did these two, three, or four people just exhibit and experience up close and personal. The brush off effect is just too high. And that, again, we've got to keep drilling down to realizing that. And I just taught a 2-day CISM seminar this past weekend, and we talked about that there is nobody in your organization, I don't care how many stars and bars they have on their uniform and how many letters are after their names, they dare not determine what is a critical incident for one of their employees and what is not. A, they don't have the right to do that, and B, they are damaging these people when they just brush this stuff off. And this is where I get excited, where I get, maybe that's not the best word, but I get very angry at some of these leadership folks that just keep brushing this off to the point that these people are just robots going through the motions 12 hours a day, and then all of that is being brought back to the home and infecting the family life. It's not just infecting the responders who are seeing this up front, but it's now being carried back to the home life and affecting the spouses, the family members of that responder who is so fried to this point, knows that they go to their supervisor and they get, here's a card for EAP or, why don't we talk for a while and see how you feel later, but aren't taking this on as a devastating effect of how well that organization is going to operate.
We've got to stop that.
We do. And you know, Joe, we talk about training and the importance of doing that. I'm wondering, you know, when you guys do your specialized disaster training at Paragon Medical Education Group, do you touch on these types of issues at all?
Well, we certainly do, you know, if the scenario is appropriate for it. I think it's not front and center, but probably, you know, in the undercurrent quite a bit. Obviously, a lot of folks in disaster response, especially early in their careers or early in their opportunities to do disaster response, there's a lot of shock and awe to it and a lot of things to distract your attention, et cetera. And obviously these issues with folks who are having trouble can tend to be subtle, tend to be hidden. You have to go looking for them. And so it's a bit of a situational awareness kind of training for folks to be on the lookout for some of those telltale signs that we've been talking about.
Joe, where can, just so we're wrapping up here, you know, where can folks find Paragon Medical Education Group? I know we really appreciate your continued sponsorship of the program and helping us to bring the disaster podcast out to people. You know, they want to talk about disaster training and specific information that you can bring to bear in their systems. Where can they contact you?
Well, thanks, Jamie. We love supporting the Disaster Podcast and are glad to be here. Folks can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And you can also find us through the Disaster Podcast or on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
And thanks again, Joe. Dan, you know, you're doing this specialized training, and if somebody wants to find out how they can bring this new program into their system or reach out to you and touch mm-hmm. base with this, where can they best reach you?
The best way to do it is right through our Facebook page, which is simply CISM Perspectives, the name of the company. On our website, we've got a very nice contact page that helps us get a lot of good information up front, and that's simply cismperspectives.com. And advice is always free, as I put that out there. But we do have programs, we'll travel, and this has become our torch that we are going to be carrying for a number of years because here in my own backyard, we've had an agency that has suffered 3 suicides in less than 5 years. I have to do something more than what's being done. And that's not to diminish anybody's efforts that are talking about this, but again, we have to change our approach and make it more of a direct approach and really make sure that these leaders are understanding what's at risk. And I'm sorry if I'm going to make you uncomfortable, but that's part of my job to get this training and education out there, and this is the way we break down the barriers, the stigmas, and if we can help one responder out there to find the inner strength that they're listening to this tonight to say, you know what, I'm going to ask my first line supervisor, what do we have in-house? Because that's often where it needs to start, is those supervisors need to be asked, what do we have in place? And embarrassingly so, they have to say, I don't know, and that can drive change.
Well, Dan, we'll make sure we have links to all that in the show notes and put it out there on our Facebook group as well, because this is an important topic. And as you said, this is something that needs to be discussed no matter how uncomfortable it makes us. And that's
absolutely
one of the reasons we're covering it here on the show this week. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for reaching out to Sam and I and making sure that we brought this topic to the forefront.
Absolutely. And thank you for giving me the opportunity and the open mic, and it's been a pleasure talking with everybody else, and just ask you to take some of the passion that you've heard and start lighting some fires out there, because this is not going away, and it's growing faster than we are anticipating it, and that scares me as a past chief, as an EMT in the streets, and now as someone who does what I do for a living.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson, where you can follow along with my adventures in the classroom, on the ski slopes, and everywhere my travels take me. So again, thanks to Dan for coming on tonight. Great episode.
Thank you, sir.
Sam, how about you?
Well, you know, before I do that, I have my Facebook page open and just noticed within the last 4 hours, somebody posted that a train hit and dragged a charter bus in Biloxi, Mississippi. Unknown number of deaths or injuries. So there we go. These are exactly the kind of thing that Dan engages with. So we hope for the best on that one, but maybe we'll know a little bit more next week. But I'm in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. Certainly on the Facebook page for Disaster Podcast and disasterpodcast.com, where you can come and tell us what you think of this episode, ask any questions that I'm sure Dan would be willing to answer for you, and give us any ideas that you think are discussion worthy, and we'd be glad to address those for you. Jamie, what about you?
Well, everybody can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels out there. And again, always over at disasterpodcast.com and on our Facebook group. Again, you can find that Facebook group just by going into Facebook and searching for Disaster Podcast. And when you find that, just request to join the group. That's all it takes. And we'll let you in and join the discussion there. It's important to have discussions on all of our topics. And this is one of the ones that I think is going to be one that we hope to have more discussion on. And we'll have to have Dan back as this program that he's kicking out there gets started and gets more feedback and more systems taking it up, that we can see what the response is like down the road. But it just goes to show us, Sam, that there's just so much more to what we do than just making the call and taking care of the patient.
Yes, and we don't think about it in terms of the personal disasters of the people that save lives for a living, and it's very unfortunate, but I'm glad that there's people like Dan that are on top of it. But it's just another example of disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.